long time, so I'm sorry.
Okay, I'd like to call this meeting to order at 6:05. So the first order of business is attendance, starting with the president, President Yamagishi. Vice President Chellen. Vice President Kuzmu. Vice President Shima. Vice President Sumar.
Present.
Governor Kelly.
Present.
Councillor Milner. Councillor Kim.
Present.
Mr. Hanwell for Councillor McGinn.
Yes, present.
Miss, I always forget how to pronounce your last name. Miss Orzik?
Yeah.
Right. Orzik for Councillor Kinda, present. Orzik, perfect. Councillor Mills?
Present.
Councillor Ruth?
Present.
Councillor Borden?
Present.
Miss Dahl for Councillor Lay?
Not present, Josh Lay.
Oh, sorry. Ooh. Councillor Holt? Councillor Smith?
Present.
Councillor Mikula? Councillor Curlew? Councillor Lang?
Present.
Councillor Crone? Councillor Baddick?
Present.
Councillor Reitz?
Present.
Is that, what's that? Proper?
Oh, Reitz.
Reitz. Okay, cool. Councillor Carson? Councillor Carson. All right, Councillor Bellinger.
Present.
Councillor Chaudhry.
Present.
Mr. Power for Councillor Champagne. Councillor Truong. Councillor Kuchi Krill. Councillor Nguyen.
In the house.
Councillor Pham. Councillor Bui. Councillor Obi Afuna.
Present.
Councillor Hodgson. And I am here, and the general manager is also here. Perfect. Okay, so first item of business is speaker's business. So just a couple quick notes. One, if you have not yet signed a confidentiality agreement and you're a member of Students Council, they are right here. Please sign one before the end of the meeting and just give them back to me. So they're going to be right here if you want one. Also, I'd like to remind you all of the oath that you have taken. And just a reminder that our next meeting of Students Council will take place on May 29th. So with that, we'll move on to our first order of business, which is actually going to be moved from the late editions. And the reason for that is that the presenters are here today. So just so you all know, I will not be making a habit of moving items from the late editions. So if you want something to be heard by Students Council, then please try to make sure it's on the main agenda. The reason today is an exception is obviously because the presenter's here, and it just makes sense for this one, but that's not going to be a general rule, so make sure you get your stuff in on time. So with that, this is going to be a presentation called the East Campus Village Housing Project, presented by Mr. Doug Dawson, who's the Director of Ancillary Service, and John O'Hara, who is the Project Manager, and is sponsored by Vice President Sumar. So with that, you have 30 minutes, and the floor is yours.
Thank you very much. Thank you for the invitation to present today. I've had the pleasure of appearing in front of a number of students' councils this year presenting a student housing project, as long as we go bringing things on. The project I'm going to start talking about today, I guess you haven't been able to see that slide, proposing to board change. In East Campus Village, which many of you are probably familiar with, some of you may even live there. East Campus Village is the area located in this area here. This is
Go ahead, sorry, Mr. Kelly.
Sorry, could you just turn his mic on?
It should be working if you...
All right, so can you hear me now?
Just
a little bit. There we go. My paper was on top. And so it was starting to say to you that East Campus Village is the area that you can see on the map. This is 110th Street. We try not to get you in the eye with this one. 110th Street and 111th Street there. Saskatchewan Drive and 87th Avenue down this way. There's the Telecenter, the law building. These are the large parking lots just to the east of Hull. So East Campus Village, or Sector 8, as our planners call it. And what you're actually looking at is a draft of a sector plan. In the city, municipalities, typically they call them area structure plans. Universities like to call them sector plans. This is just to give you a little bit of an indication of what the future holds as we build out East Campus Village. It's a discussion of things like pathways. You can see the way our university's architect imagines it connecting through to the main campus, the way the pathways will eventually run up through to the river valley and then through into the community and down to Sugar Bowl and some of the other amenities down towards 109th Street. So it is intended, the diagram that you're looking at is intended to be a very basic high-level discussion of how a community will evolve over time and as funds become available to develop them. What you can see along 87th Avenue and up 110th Street, here are the four buildings recently completed, 1, 2, 3, 4, for the graduate student housing. We call that Park Lane East Campus Village Graduate Student Housing Buildings 1 through 4. And that was completed about a year ago last September. The buildings we're here to talk to today about are here and here. On 89th Avenue, and the buildings that we're looking at, a total of 244 beds in two buildings. Building number two with 124 beds. I'm sorry, yes, 124 beds here. And this building is, given its proximity, if I can go backwards, to the, if you come around the corner from the building number four, the graduate student housing over here, the intent is that this building will serve as kind of transition housing, primarily targeted at to graduate students. The four buildings of graduate student housing are comprised of studio and two-bedroom apartments. This building will be two-bedroom and four-bedroom apartments, furnished as they were in the other four buildings recently completed. So that building, there will be two houses on the block remaining, here and here, and two in the center. So you can see this is, I think that's the Fiji house, and then we have two houses that will remain on the block. A total of nine houses will be removed from 89th Avenue. Building A here is going to have 152 beds. And it is being designed with all four bedroom apartments. And those are, this building, given its proximity and eventual build a connection to International House, this building is being designed in a way that we hope will appeal to international students attending the University of Alberta seeking a degree program. This is a, what you're looking at for the next few slides, I have to reiterate every time I show these, despite the fact that they look like very cool designs, these are just computer renderings. We feed data into computers and they now spit out these types of things just to give you an idea of what a typical layout might be. The ultimate design and fit-ups and materials and everything is still a matter of discussion that the Oversight Committee, which consists of two of your executive members here, graduate students and our project team, will sit down with our builders and determine what the final layout should be. This is a typical four-bedroom layout of the type recently completed at the University of Saskatchewan, where you have four beds, of course, a common living area, there's a little pantry area, and the shower pretty area, and then the sinks are outside of that area so that you can maximize the usage of it. And that gives you an idea of what that might look like. This is a layout for a potential two-bedroom, and that's another two-bedroom there. This is very similar to what we did in East Campus Village Grad, where
the bedrooms are separated by the living area, and then a common kitchen area, of course, and a single bathroom. That's just another concept there. Now we're beginning to look at what these, now again, these are just computer-generated renderings to provide us with a sense of scale on how these buildings might sit in East Campus Village. In 2002, the university negotiated with the Garneau community and other stakeholders a set of design guidelines. And the concern, I think, at the time, the university might develop these properties in a way that might be inconsistent with the look and feel of the existing community, the textures and articulation of the what they call craft-style houses in the Garneau area. So working with the Garneau community and the consulting team, we looked at all the houses in the neighborhood and captured what we thought were the color schemes and the different articulations, the roof styles, and brought those back. And the best examples of that are the East Campus Village graduate student housing that you can see, where there's extensive brick on the porches, and the articulated windows and roof lines are very characteristic. The color schemes are very characteristic of what you'll see in the Garneau community houses to the east. So we're picking up on this again. These are just renderings, so the colors are mute on purpose. This is a mansard roof as opposed to a dormer roof, but again, not dissimilar to what you might find in the houses in East Campus Village. So again, this is intended to just give you an idea of the scale. You'll notice on this building, unlike the graduate students housing, where there are private entrances going up and down, so the first two floors have private entrances on both sides of the building. These will be more traditional, single entrance lobby elevators and double loaded corridors going up, so more traditional apartment style. This is a view looking west along 89th Avenue. The trees have all been conveniently removed for you there. We'll put them back in a minute. And you can see these are just massing studies of what the two houses in the center of the block will look like. There's the Fiji house. And again, you can see the articulation of the buildings picking up on the craft style and the contrasting materials that we intend to use. Again, completely different again, but this time looking east and looking at the structure that we're proposing. This is International House, so we're looking at joining these buildings. Our colleagues at University of Alberta International tell us that one of the things that they really want is a large assembly area where they can bring large numbers of international students and Canadian students together for programming activities. So we're hoping to achieve that here. Some interesting things go on the roof, we don't know. John will have to see if he can save me some money when he does that. This is a view from the back of the buildings. You'll remember building B is a U-shaped building. Well, now you're looking at the inside of that U and presents a nice sort of a courtyard area. These aren't designs, but for example, every floor has an amenity social space where there might be large televisions, lounge spaces. They could easily open out onto the space with decks and a little bit of hard and soft landscaping, be suitable for barbecues, those sorts of things. So very pleasant south-facing courtyard areas in there. We put a little landscaping in there for you. Again, I apologize for this. That kind of looks like a giant castle wall, but that's just intended to show the scale of the housing community to the south. You're looking down the parking lot, and you're looking in the west at the you're looking towards the west down the back of the buildings. So the point of this being the back of the buildings will be turned into functional space. We put some snow on the ground for you for these views. This is if there weren't any buildings across the street, you can take a look at the long panoramic view of what's being proposed. You can see the buildings, according to the design guidelines, we're required to step them down as we get towards the community, so you can see how it drops, and then drops down a scale as it approaches the community. Very important for them that we try to respect the scale of the existing housing. There's the two houses that will remain and the two houses on the end of the block. You can see, although it's winter shot, the tree canopy has been maintained, and we will respect that. The street appeal of these buildings, we believe, is going to be quite attractive We think we were very successful, our design consultants were very successful with the four recently completed residences, and did a very good job with respect to the streetscape while incorporating some zero-scaping and some other sustainability measures into the landscape. And that is a very brief show. I hope I have less time, Mr. Speaker, for some questions.
Yes, indeed. There is still 10 minutes remaining. So, did you want me to field the questions for you?
Sure, whatever you like.
Okay, Governor Kelly.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker, and thank you for the presentation. If you could just talk a little bit about sort of the community consultation that went into, or like sort of with regards to that, what's gone into consulting with the community and sort of the responses from the community, the Gardner community, regarding this new project. Thank you.
Yes, the Gardner community, there's two activities going on simultaneously. The very first slide that I showed you was a sector planning slide. The university in, I think, 2002 required under the Post-Secondary Learning Act to post with the minister a long-range development plan to present to the minister. The minister has accepted that plan. As the university moves through, I think there's about 14 or 15 sectors, the sector planning activity of the type you saw must evolve. There's a series of open houses, series of meetings with the Gardner community. They have a steering committee and then meetings with the larger community. So those are prescribed in the appendix to the long range development plan. We must have a predetermined number of meetings. Minutes are kept, they're sent back to the community for verification that in fact that was what was discussed, and then we move forward with it. So that process is going on. Now, the housing project that we're talking about tonight came up very, very quickly as a result of the President's PAC 2015 vision and became a very a live project in January. So we put together a very quick project, and we superimposed the consultation of the sector surrounding the approval of the potential approval of the sector plan with this project. Now we can do that because the south portion of the sector is unaffected from the original long-range development plan. So when we built the graduate student housing, for example, because we weren't affecting the long-term land use, there was no major changes to the sector plan, so we were able to get approval to move that project forward. These housing projects are in that same quadrant, if you will. The northern half of the Sector 8 actually had a very, very large car park situated on it, which has since been removed by the university, so it is subject to amendment. And so we would have, before we did anything in that area, we would have to go through a long, long, long process. So the two processes are a little bit superposed. There have been a series of meetings. Your president and his colleagues may have seen them at the Board of Governors. Were required to list out all the consultation processes that we've undertaken.
Perfect.
Long answer, I'm sorry.
Mr. Power.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. My question is regarding whether it's the new developments are targeted for undergrads or for graduate students.
Building B is targeted for graduate students. Building A is for international students who we assume would be undergraduate students. Having said that, if we can't fill them up, they'll be open to everybody.
Okay. Sorry, Councilor Lay.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. Thank you for the presentation. Just two quick questions. Would you be able to clarify what transition housing is and who's funding this project?
I'm sorry, who's
funding this project?
The transition housing is my term, just meaning that it's transitioning around the corner from the existing graduate student housing. So we're providing some two-bedroom accommodation that we know was popular with the four buildings completed, and then we're moving into four-bedroom, which we know is a little bit less expensive when we complete it. So that's nothing to it other than that. The building is being funded by a combination of debt financing and equity, traditional, just as you would buy a home.
Thank you very much. Vice President Kuzmu.
Thank you, Mr. Thank you, Mr. Speaker, and thanks a lot for the presentation. I was just wondering, and I hope I didn't miss this, but what kind of sustainability initiatives that this building is aiming to get, if this could be any kind of whatever it's called.
Other. Thank you for asking that. I'm glad I brought an engineer. There's always options when you do construction to certify your building through a program that most of you would be familiar with called LEED. The LEED is not the only program that is out there. There's the Green Building Council, and there's other ways of certifying buildings to be environmentally friendly, to have reduced carbon footprint, etc. We could pursue a LEED certification, but there is a cost to doing that. On a large building, getting a certification could cost $1 million or more. That wouldn't be the cost of these ones, but our preference is to put as much area into the building as we can. John could probably give you a little more information, but I know the graduate student housing, if we chose to certify it, we could probably attain a LEED Gold with all the xeriscaping and high efficiency equipment that we put in it. We have a very, very good university architect and project management group that will be looking after that. So it is our intent to put as much modern technology as we can in the building. But it is unlikely that we will certify it as LEED Gold. We simply don't want to chase the points for that and pay for the consultants to come and do it. So John, did you have said earlier?
Yeah, through the Office of through the University Architect, the Office of Sustainability, we work with them through the design-build process and charge the design team with coming up with the sustainability systems that the university wants to see in that structure, those structures. So it's a consultative process as we go through.
Vice President Sumar.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker, and thank you again for coming. So just a quick question about the sort of the connection between the International House and the new buildings. Will that affect pedestrian traffic?
Yeah, you know, we heard that from the community. There's a few people that like to shortcut right through where we're proposing to do that. I guess the short answer is yes, it will affect the informal movement, but the intent, of course, is that, as you saw on the first plan, when the sector is completely built out, they have bike paths and pedestrian pathways throughout. And the way I like to do those, of course, is get a bit of altitude and watch where the people are wearing out the grass. Some of you may wonder how all those sidewalks got put on the quad. It was nothing more than watching where the grass got worn out over the last 30 years as a result of the sidewalks. So we do have a bit of that, but you're quite right to point that out. Other members in the community did as well. So we'll certainly take a look at that. We're also looking at areas, the slides are down now, but the area that you're concerned with, the area that you're pointing out, that creates a little bit of a natural quad behind there. So we're quite interested in how we incorporate sort of the indoor spaces outdoors and use it for their programming in that regard. So we may have lost a little opportunity, but it creates some of them.
President Yamagishi.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker, and thank you for coming to the presentation on short notice. My question is in regards to residence life, if we have like a system or a structure set up to see first of all, like how many RAs and residence coordinators we'll have, and where we would find these residence coordinators and residence assistants from if we don't have this residence existing yet.
That's a really good question. I should have brought you Luke up. I can answer from a financial perspective that the financial reform approved by the board could include residence life program for both of these buildings, so it has it's been budgeted. As for the pool of RAs and others that would work in it, Colton, you might know more than I or the Honorable Speaker about how those are selected. But we have certainly ensured it's a very valuable program. Our Vice President Provo has been very clear that if we did not have residence life programming, we would have to wonder why we were in the residence business. So we're quite committed to providing it. Council may also be aware, of course, obviously there's an intensity to the programming that tends to diminish as a student moves through their academic career, the most intense being in places like Lister Hall, of course, and then the likely least intense being our graduate students have a different focus on life.
Councillor Shoji.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. I was just wondering what the anticipated completion date is.
It's more than anticipated. It must actually be the third week in August of 2013. My project manager. There really is only one time we can open students. Well, for that matter, there's really only one time we can open most university buildings. And that's in time for the commencement of the fall term. So those are the timelines. It's very quick. But again, I've got a very sharp team, and I'm absolutely confident that we'll get done.
Are there any further questions? Oh, sorry, Mr. Babick. Oh, I'm sorry, I skipped you. My apologies.
No worries, Mr. Speaker. Thank you. Just got a couple of quick questions. They're a little bit simple, you know, to make my events here, but who owns the land and houses that are being built on? And secondly, why are we so strictly conforming to the look, feel of the neighborhood, vis-a-vis the draft colors, et cetera?
Thanks for your questions. Land is owned by the university. It is part of a parcel of land, if I may just indulge in a little bit of history, that back in the 1970s, I think, was expropriated by the university. The university at that time, up until about 2002, had the rights of expropriation as a municipality might or as a government. It exercised that right in the 70s, anticipating that it was going to expand to the east. That expansion didn't occur due to shifts in the economy over time. So the houses remained and were converted into student housing for the period of time. The negotiations that resulted in the design guidelines, which is what I think you're referring to, were difficult conversations with the community whose memory is long, and were concerned that the university had expropriated the houses and had not done what it said it was going to do. The issues of the compromises that we had to reach over 2.5 years were those that I described earlier, and that was that as we would do a very detailed study of the community, that as we would prepare and present for approval a set of guidelines that would form future architectural teams as to the scale of the buildings, material selections, the general look and feel of the architecture, and most importantly, the community density in the fullness of time with the there. So it was a 2.5 year consultation process with our neighbors that resulted in those decisions.
Thank you very much. And I was not giving priority, Councillor Babick. I apologize for that. Your name was covered by a piece of paper. Are there any further questions? Okay, then thank you very much to the presenters. Nope. I did. Oh, your USB as well. So the next up is the presentation on the Students' Union Building Lower Level Renovations, presented by Andy Chima, Vice President of Operations and Finance, and Mark Dumichel, General Manager, sponsored by Vice President Chima. Is there a seconder for this? Councillor Bellinger, is there any opposition to seeing this presentation? Great. The floor is yours.
Okay, so I'm here with Mark Dumichel, who's our general manager, and he works closely with the operations of the Students' Union as well as the Executive Committee, and him and I have worked very closely over the past year on the sub-renovation project. So the purpose of this presentation is to basically bring everybody up to speed on the project. You've all probably heard me speak about it, whether it's through the elections or through council reports or on one-on-one conversations, and this is an opportunity for everybody to develop a baseline amount of knowledge so that we can assume that amount of knowledge we move forward in decisions guiding the next steps of the process. So we'll be talking about the history of the Students' Union Building and the history of this project within that greater history. We'll speak about the project goals for this renovation and how those align with the university and strategic planning documents. And we will be doing a review of the feasibility study which was conducted last year. As well as the process for moving forward. And then at the end, if there's any time, we'll open it up for questions and comments. So the history of the Students' Union Building and this renovation project. Way back when, the Students' Union Building was actually the building that we're in now, University Hall. But it soon became apparent that this building did not meet the needs of the organization. So this This led to the construction of the current student senior building, which opened in 1967. It was built for a cost of $6.5 million, and it was a very preeminent building at the time. It was featured in Time magazine, and it was a well-regarded building in the 60s. This was a collaborative project between the university and the students' union. The building has since been renovated three times. There's been three major renovations, the first in 1993, the second in 1998, and the third in 2003. The 93 renovation was by the Students Union, and this was done in response to leased space, which was the tenants withdrew from the space, and we were left with a void in the building. So the food court was added in this renovation, and because of the increased revenues for food sales, the renovation was self-financing. The second major renovation happened in 1998. This was a university renovation to centralize student services on the second floor of sub. Prior to this point in time, student services were fragmented across campus, and the result of this renovation was to more sensibly and conveniently co-locate university services into a one-stop shop on the second floor of sub. And then the third and final renovation was joint between the Students Union and the university, and it was on the main floor. The space that now surrounds substage, the great room of sub, was previously a concrete windswept courtyard, and the result of this renovation was to transform that exterior space into interior space in the building. It was an infill project, so we closed that courtyard. However, enrollment continues to grow, programs continue to grow, and student needs continue to evolve over time. And this results in increased space pressures. In 2008, in response to these space pressures, the SU began to discuss solutions to that problem. In 2010, early 2010, something that's called the General Space Program was published. A general space program is a process used to identify, quantify, and justify space use and to project future space needs based on current trends. The upshot of this program was that it validated our need for more space and more space of almost all types. The logical response to this result was to discuss expansion. However, over the course of conversations with representatives from facilities and operations at the university, it became apparent that an expansion per se was not currently feasible. So you can begin to see the constraints that we're working under. How do we ease our space pressures within the constraints of a non-flexible amount of square footage? And the answer to that is really adjusting our existing footprint to increase space efficiency. So over to you, Mark.
Okay, so what were the goals we identified for the project? I'm going to get up and walk around because those of you who've seen me before know I like to. I'm very sorry. And it's good to see many of you back this year. And I'm sorry if you get bored about the same presentation for about the third time. But the first goal, when we started considering how this, what we should do with it, what we should do for the next evolution of stuff, well, what do we want to do? Well, the number one goal that we had was we wanted to ensure that Sub remained kind of the central place on campus that was the home and the hub of student engagement on campus. Not just with the Students Union, but also with student groups, with our services, with other volunteer opportunities. So we want to make better use of the space to encourage and support student engagement activities. She's not noticing. and to create an involvement center on the lower level. Second key goal that we had for it is we have a bunch of student services, and if you go down to our services and then go up to the second floor where the university services are, you know, you realize that we kind of make our staff feel like second-class citizens. The space just is not as good. It's very hidden. It's not very inspiring. If you've been into the back of our offices, it's very random and very maze-like. It's like you can stick a rat in there and then, I don't know, have some kind of reward and see what happens. So we wanted to improve the quality of that space. That's our second key goal. The third one is, you know, if you're going to be promoting engagement, you're going to be providing a home for students. Now, a student's union, the traditional concept of the student's union is the living room of campus. And a key part of that is making sure that the building itself has a certain vibrancy to it. When we did the infill project in 2003, created the substage area, it really transformed the building. It made it a lot more active. And we want to continue to build on that. So the key third key goal was increase the vibrancy of the building. So we're, as our staff will tell you, I go on about this all the time, we're a very strategically driven organization. We have a strategic plan. We try to ensure that everything that we do aligns with the principles in that plan. So the next question is, how do these things align with our strategic plan? And because we're part of a larger community, how does it align with the university strategic plan, which is called the academic plan? Well, with our strategic plan, we have two goals that this really contributes very directly to. The first is to establish an environment that promotes student spirit and involvement and maximizes students' sense of ownership of their students' union and their university experience. That, to us, is what engagement is all about. Strategic goal 5 is support the educational and university experience of students by providing relevant programs and services. And again, part of the renovation goals is to improve our ability to deliver our services and university services to students. Whatever we do in the organization, we also try to ensure upholds our key strategic values, stewardship, and these are words which are encompass a set of values. It isn't just one thing. If you haven't read our strategic plan, I urge you to. Stewardship, which is about good governance, being innovative, showing compassion, which is about building community and being respectful and inclusive in our activities, sustainability, of course, and promoting the values of citizenship. The university's academic plan is structured around four cornerstones, and we feel that the renovation project contributes to three of them. Talented people, specifically supporting the development and leadership development and diversity among the student population. Promoting learning, discovery, and citizenship, so we align with that. And because we try to make SUB into a place where the whole community connects, we view it as a great opportunity to fulfill the fourth cornerstone, which is connecting communities. Okay, so Randy, I'm going to turn it over to you.
Yeah, so I mentioned the feasibility study that we conducted last year. It began in late August and it was published and released to council in January. So most of it took place over the fall of 2011. And the purpose of the feasibility study was to investigate A, whether a renovation was possible, and B, if so, whether it would be practical. So the idea was to refine what the resource requirements would be in general to pursue renovation and what the major obstacles would be, if any. The feasibility study was an assessment of the needs, opportunities, and strategy behind renovation. An assessment of resource requirements, review of building code and building system issues, and fundamentally it was a starting point. And I really want to emphasize that it was a starting point. It was not a final design, a complete solution, and it's not set in stone. It's merely something to allow us to frame our discussions and to base further investigations off of.
Okay, so the first thing we did when we met with our architects was they wanted to get a feel for what kind of place we wanted to create. And we did this through reviewing what they called precedent images. So they brought in a bunch of pictures of places that had elements that we might want to incorporate into our building. So the first one was this. We came very quickly to the conclusion that whatever we do, we needed to make the building more open, welcoming, and bright, particularly that lower level, which right now is a basement. And because it's a basement, we're not really getting full value out of that floor. People don't go down to it. They don't even know it's there a lot of the time. Secondly, it needed to be fun and friendly. It needed to be something that was reflective of students. We also wanted to do something to connect the lower level with the rest of the building. And we wanted to make the building feel like more of a whole facility. We talked about how the whole fit together. And I'm going a little fast because we haven't got a whole lot of time here. So Andy?
So following the precedent image presentation, the next step that our architects undertook was to take the actual floor plans in the first two floors of the building and then to overlay zones and some crude design elements over top. So this, if you can't tell, it's the main floor of the Students' Union building. Up is north, down is south, left is west, and right is east. And the two red arrows are the two major axes of foot traffic flow. The green space is the substage area, the student commons area. And then the yellow space on top of the green space is what's currently occupied by SubMart and surrounding businesses. And the strip of yellow on the right-hand side is seating and food court. The major changes, which may be a bit difficult to see, but which Mark will highlight, are the rectangle below the green, and then there's a rectangle on the right as well. And these are zones which would be cut into the floor to vertically connect the first floor and the second floor to allow the penetration of natural light into the basement. And, sorry, did I say? the first floor and the lower level to allow light to enter into the basement. This is the lower level, so same orientation. The top left corner is the bookstore, bottom right is mechanical, bottom left is existing offices and an elevator and whatnot. The central area is proposed to be a student commons area, effectively a lounge, something that's open for public student use, and which would be flanked by student groups area. So a zone of space that's focused around student group involvement and student group administration.
These are where the cutouts were, if you could see. So these under their initial drawings, were going to be places where it was open to above. But, oops.
So this is what these two drawings would look like in cross-section.
There's supposed to be a wall of glass here. You can't tell.
Yeah, that's a wall of glass. And the first floor, you can see how it's been cut out away from the wall. And you can see how that provides that connectivity to the lower level. However, that creates problems. It results in a substantial percentage of our existing social space being lost. And the Students' Union is an advocate for increased social space on campus. Furthermore, the main floor of the building is arguably the most effective and best run aspect of our building. So as Mark likes to say, I'm going to steal your line here, why perform open heart surgery on that floor of the building that already works? In addition, we'd be losing retail space and we would interfere with the current circulation patterns, which are also quite effective for that space in the building. So there were some problems with that initial approach. This is the alternative option that was identified. So now we're looking at a bird's eye view of the building. Again, up is north, down is south. And what you can see has been done here is there's been a narrow addition to the building. So this part here is a glass atrium, 15 feet deep, that extends from the south face of the building, which is then dug out in front to allow for a lower level direct entrance. And this is an alternative to actually cutting into the floor. Instead of having to cut into the floor, this extends that vertical airspace into what's currently outside of the building. It turns out that doing it that way is actually cheaper than cutting into the floor because of all the building systems that exist between the first floor and the main and the lower level. And additionally, it increases the square footage and visually probably has superior aesthetics as well.
So let's get into that. Now again, as Andy noted, these aren't final designs. We started talking first about, we've gone through a couple of different iterations and we don't know what we'll finally settle on in terms of what that atrium might look like. We ended up with, for the purposes of the feasibility study, going with this design here. Well, I went a little early, sorry Andy.
Oh, that's okay.
And this is kind of a rendering of what it might look like. Again, very, very preliminary. But the idea is to create some terracing here, some more social space on the exterior, entrances on the lower level and on the main level, and the ability for light to enter into the lower level and for you to see a vision, and from inside the building you can see down into the lower level to provide kind of that connection. It increases the floor space of the building slightly. So the whole idea is that we felt it created a more dynamic and transparent kind of effect. This is a drawing, if you looked at the documents we posted for the referendum, this is one of the ones that we used. This gives you a bit of another kind of perspective on it. The university, this is preliminary, the university has some concerns about us coming out quite as far as we are in this case, and we're going to talk to them about what they're comfortable with, but we want to create both space outside that can be used and improve the quality of the space inside. It should be noted that right over here is where the PAW entrance is going to be coming out, so it's a real opportunity for us to work with the university in redeveloping this whole area here to make it more attractive. So create a different feel and have a unifying vision for the lower level. We wanted to do that. Student involvement and engagement are the themes. What can we do with the building to provide student groups with the support and space they need? And how do we help students find the clubs, programs, and extracurricular activities they want? These are the questions that we thought about when we turned to the question of interior design. And we went through like one, two, three, there's a couple more versions of interior design. And a lot of these ones, early ones that we went through, Council, people who were here last year remember when we came in November or December, it was a very blocky kind of design. And I left Council talking to our architect. And I said, you know what? They're okay. They'll do for now, but we really need something that's really going to kind of bring the place together, make it feel very humane and organic. And I didn't ask them to do this, but he actually came back 2 weeks later. They sat down, they agreed with us, and they came up with this more organic kind of design for how we create our group and services space. It's closed. It will be. There's a lot in this drawing you can't see because of the projector and the lights, but this area is also segmentable. There's actually some space in here that gets used up as well. But on this side, basically, we'd be creating on the lower level a student groups and services area with an involvement center probably centered around here. Again, preliminary, but that's kind of where we're looking at right now. A few retail spaces to help pay the bills, so to speak. And we may look at, for example, moving subprint from the back of the building, the bowels of the building, up front so it gets a little more usage. Those of you who are really sharp will notice that we basically cut off the front of the university bookstore. We actually own that space. We lease it to them right now. We have to talk to them some more about it. We've told them that's kind of our intent. And in the back here, you can't see, we want to create a suite of meeting rooms and large multi-purpose rooms as facilities for student groups. So we want to provide more facilities for student groups. Again, pretty preliminary, but that's kind of the rough direction we're heading right now. We had to do some renderings of what it might look like. And there's no decor in this, but you get a feel for how the space would feel when you're inside. This would be looking north towards the bookstore near the entrance. And this would be looking out, looking south through the atrium. Part of the top would be open to the second floor, so people from the second floor could see down. But you get a lot of, I mean, on a sunny day, how fantastic would that be, eh? But that's awesome. I just love that. it would really transform the lower level. I mean, when you look at some of these renderings, you just go, yeah, I totally get it. So we can make this work, we'll make it work. The feasibility study did more than just kind of mock up a design for us to price out. And this design was to price out. There's, like, as Andy said, lots of miles to go yet in this project. We also looked at mechanical, structural, and electrical systems. Didn't find any big obstacles. One of the interesting things that I found is they did a whole report on what the temperature be in these various sections here. So we've got actual detailed projections of what the temperature is going to be like on January 20th, which is the coldest day of the year apparently, through various 1 meter slices of this space here. Really cool. Okay, so I'm going to turn it over to Andy to talk about the process because that's his.
Yeah, so I will. I'll talk about the process. I'll talk about what's happened up until now, localize our current state within that, and then talk about the major steps and milestones for moving forward. So we discussed the feasibility study that was presented to Council in January, and in response to the feasibility study, the findings of that, Council decided to move forward with a referendum to ask A, whether students are interested in us pursuing this further, and B, whether they would be willing to pay a $9 fee to support and partially finance the renovations. So the referendum took place in March, and it was passed, thus approving a potential fee of $9 per term to help pay for the renovation. I say it's a potential fee because the referendum contained a provision that states that the fee will not begin to be collected until Council has approved the design for the renovation at a stage called design development. So in general terms, we'll be moving forward with a collegial and collaborative approach with the university and with all stakeholders that reflect both our values and the university's values. We'll also be actively involving the community, whether that's students, whether that's tenants in the building, and whether that's other stakeholders within the university community. The project will be driven by a steering committee, which will have representation from various stakeholder groups, including facilities and operations at the university, the dean of students, potentially user groups from within the building, and of course representatives from council and from the students' union. The steering committee will also oversee a design subcommittee, which will be tasked with the more fine-grained details of design elements and how do we really optimize the space to meet the needs of student groups, student services, and students. The design committee will also be tasked with managing consultations with stakeholders, reconciling differences, and finding areas of synergy between different parties' needs. We will be working with a project manager who was involved in the last two renovations of the Students' Union building and who has been guiding us throughout this project for the last, almost the last year now. And the expected architect for the project moving forward is Dialog. Dialog is the architecture engineering firm that helped us prepare the feasibility study, and we look forward to working with them further.
They're also working on the UBC building.
So we'll be taking the same general approach as other university buildings. We do operate within university environment and therefore within the university capital project governance framework. In terms of the university terminology, we're moving out of the project assessment phase into the definition phase. And we'll be doing stakeholder consultations throughout the summer with a target to complete a schematic design report in September. Subsequent to that, we will be consulting heavily with students and revising the design of that report and further refining it to develop what's called the design development report with the target presentation date of January. This will be coupled with a complete budget and financing model for the project, which would allow us to ideally begin construction by mid-2013 and open doors by the third week of August 2014, which is apparently the only time you can open a building on the campus. And that would also coincide with the timeline for the PAWS Center, so we could very realistically be looking at a opening that coincides with the fall opening. So just in terms of the governance of this project and the principles underlying it, the overarching principles will come from the referendum provisions that were voted on by students in March. We talked about that briefly already. All major decisions moving forward will follow the following route. They will be vetted by the steering committee, which will make recommendations to the executive committee, and the executive committee will then bring decisions to Students' Council for ultimate approval. Any of these decisions which have a financial component will be referred to the Budget and Finance Committee of Council for feedback or approval where necessary prior to coming to Council, just to ensure that the relevant legislative bodies have been consulted. And then following approval of the design development report, the project would be deemed to be formally approved by Council. And at that point in time, we would take it to the university and channel it through their governance procedures. And in the very short term, in 2 weeks' time, Students' Council will be asked to provide guidance on the next step of the project. So we'll be bringing a few motions forward, including confirmation of our current architect and project manager, confirmation of funding to drive the development of the next set of design reports, as well as motions to ratify the committee terms of reference and to provide nominations from council to the steering committee. And that's it for the presentation. Do you have any final words before we open it up?
Nope, that's perfect. We have 6 minutes. Six and a half minutes.
Yes, so there are only 6.5 minutes, so I suggest keeping questions and answers quick, starting with Mr. Power.
What is the Involvement Center? Like, what was the idea behind it, and what is it actually going to be in view? Thanks.
It won't be a new service. It won't necessarily be a new service per se. I think that what we're looking to do is consolidate, because we're going to have student groups in that area and student services. We want to create kind of a front desk. So right now you can go to SGS and inquire about student groups. We want to create a place where students can go and get information about volunteer opportunities, our service volunteer opportunities, and student groups. And what that looks like exactly is something that we're still trying to define. But what we want to do is create a focal point on campus for that, because there really isn't right now if you're trying to get involved. So we welcome your suggestions, your further suggestions, Councilor Power.
Vice President Sumar.
Thank you very much, Mr. Speaker, and thanks for the wonderful presentation. Just a quick question that Mark, you spoke on a little bit. How much rent will we be losing because of the loss?
Off the top of my head, it's approximately $45,000, but we will regain it through other space that we're making available. The actual change in rents, we're estimating right now. We've done an analysis of kind of what the positive and negative impacts on leases will be. We expect it to be roughly a wash.
Okay.
We'll make a little bit more on leases when this is all done than before, but not a lot. Just enough to cover the extra cleaning costs of the space.
Councillor Lay.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. Thanks for the presentation. You spoke towards the end of the presentation that you'll be consulting heavily with students. What will that look like? Or how is that going to happen?
So that process will begin in September and will take place over the fall semester. The exact structure remains to be decided by working with the steering committee and the design committee, the design subcommittee of the steering committee, as ultimately approved by Students' Council. So it's something that we want to be collaborative. We want to have both public opportunities for students from a wide variety of backgrounds to be involved. We also want to target different stakeholder groups, whether it's student groups, whether it's Students' Council. And ultimately what we want is to provide a broad and transparent venue for students to receive information and provide their guidance on the project.
I also want to note our timeline is an ideal timeline. We think we can achieve it. We achieved it last year, but it is still pretty aggressive. It is our commitment, though, to really get the design development signed off on this council year. We can't really; it's not really appropriate to carry over to a new one. But that may also mean that consultation starts in October. It kind of depends on when we get the first schematic design report done. I just don't want to raise any expectations.
Mr. Hanwell.
If that's okay, Councillor Lay, can I ask
you? Great. Governor Kelly.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker, and thanks very much for the presentation. My question is with regards to the steering committee, which you mentioned, and having been on the sub-planning steering committee last year, which was really great. Will it be sort of do you anticipate that it will be sort of similar? I realize you mentioned they have yet to sort of approve the terms of reference, but do you anticipate it will be sort of similar with sort of equal like constituents from council and things like that? So if you can just talk a little bit about that, thanks.
Yeah, so in broad terms, it will be conceptually similar in the sense that it's a body that provides guidance and direction to this capital project. It's different in a few different ways. One is that the phase of the project is different, so the specific types of decisions, the specific types of information that they'll be receiving and providing, the specific content of the conversations will be different. Because it's now a more involved phase and it's funded now, and it's something that we're much more confident that we can move forward with now, given the democratic push from students. It's something that will be more structured, better defined, and it will have broader representation as well. The previous steering committee had internal representation. There were members of Students' Council, members from Students' Union Senior Management and Executive. This one will also have other stakeholder groups and constituencies from the university.
Mr. Power, 1 minute, 30 seconds.
Hi, thanks again. I was just wondering what kind of businesses, I think I heard mentioned that there'll be businesses at the lower level. What kind of businesses will those be in? How they fit with the kind of the concept of the lower level as a student group oriented business?
That hasn't been decided yet. I think that's one of the things we need to consult with students on. I wouldn't say this is a slam dunk, but I would say it's pretty likely that we'll move subprint forward. And I think there's a good chance that the bookstore may be interested in, because we're taking away some of their space and leasing other space, but I can't say for sure. I think we also have to listen in our consultations to what students think would be good things to have in the building. Every year we ask this as part of the student survey, and we get certain responses back, and I'd like to actually, I think the group should talk to students one-on-one and kind of work through some of those options with them.
Councillor Lay.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. You mentioned that there were, well, you only mentioned three of the four Heritage Discovery Corners, so what was the fourth one that was missing and why?
Don't know off the top of my head. Stumped by council. We could look it up for you on the internet. I forget exactly what it was, but it was the most for, like, it wasn't particularly relevant. But three out of four ain't bad. You've got to give us some credit, Councillor Lay.
Thank you very much. And with that, our time is up. So thank you very much to the presenters.
Can you switch the
Okay, so the next item of business is item 7A, and that is because nominations are always a special order to take place right after presentations, in case you're curious. So the motion is, Chima moves to appoint one Students' Union Counselor to serve on the Health Center Advisory Group. Is there a seconder for this motion? Vice President Sumar. So nominations are open. You may nominate yourself or other members of council.
What part of information is
Councillor Blay.
Wasn't there a councillor nominated for the meeting last? Oh, just one.
Oh. I suppose actually I should probably give the introduction. Yeah, that was a. That would have been an appropriate point of order. So, Vice President Chima, would you care to introduce?
Yeah, certainly, Mr. Speaker. So the Health Center Advisory Group is an advisory group for the Health Center, but also more broadly, the University of Wellness Services. The group has representation from the Dean of Students, from the ECC and the Graduate Students Association. And fundamentally, it's going to ensuring that there's accountability and a good flow of information regarding how the health services fee is allocated and how those units operate. Myself and the Vice President Student Life sit on the group, and there's space for two members of Student Council on the group. At the last meeting of council, we nominated one member, so there's one remaining seat.
Thank you very much, Mr. Vice President. So with that, now we'll move into nominations. I believe Councillor Bellinger had his placard raised. Okay. Sure. Mr. Vice President, I'll allow you to take that if you'd like.
I believe it's Councillor Ritz.
Are there any nominations? Councillor Bellinger.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. I'd love to nominate myself.
Great. I assume you accept.
Yep.
Are there any further nominations? Vice President Sumar. Councillor Lay, do you accept?
Yes, I respectfully decline.
Councillor Lay declines. Is there any further nominations? With that, congratulations to Councillor Bellinger. So the next item of business is the Executive Committee reports. Is there any members of the Executive Committee who would care to make an oral report? Vice President Chellen.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. Two items of note. The first is today was announced that Dr. Jonathan Schaefer is the main dean at the Faculty of Science. Something that wasn't publicized is that Jonathan Schaefer is moving from the Vice Provost and Information Technology position to the Dean of Science position, and Dr. Tony Sapkar will be replacing him. And today was also announced that Martin Ferguson Pell will be reappointed as the dean of the Faculty of Rehab Med. Kind of you that are in those faculties, so I congratulate you and Dean. The second thing is that I would plug it in my committee or in my councils. Please, if you have any friends that are interested in staying on the TSC subcommittee, just let me know. We've got spots open on Facilities Development Committee, Nominating Committee, Undergraduate Awards and Fellowship Committee, Academic Appeals Committee, and the University Appeals Board. These are the subcommittees of the highest governing body of the U of A, and I really encourage you to consider applying. Otherwise, I would welcome any questions. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Vice President Kuzmin.
Thank you, Speaker. So, the President and I have just got back from our CAP college retreat. That's our official lobby group. We had it in Canmore this weekend. Two new developments. I got selected to be the new Vice Chair for our cause, so that's going to be fun. And B, we took back home what was rightfully ours, the Border Cup. It's a disc golf tournament. UC, for the, you know, have yet to put the name on this cup, you know, 5 years of this has existed, and this will be 2 years in a row that we'll bring it back home, so fine, it'll be great.
Thank you very much. Are there any further members? President Yamagishi.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. So I've actually only been in the office for about 4 days in the last 2 weeks. A council treat went really, executive treat went really, really well. I think the team has bonded quite nicely, maybe a little bit too much. But there's that, and then this last weekend I was at the college retreat with the Westwood and External. Just a few things that I've been up to. I guess the Tuesday I was in a provost review advisory committee, so the provost is kind of like second in command for the university, but ends up running almost all of the operations from the highest level. So we reviewed his job as he is coming back for another term after he takes a 1 year vacation to recover and explore a few things. But it went really, really well. I had my first Board of Governors meeting on Friday, and I guess we looked at a few things like the housing project that you just looked at right here. We also had some consultation on that happened the day before, on Thursday. Other than that, we had a Board of Governors dinner that the Vice President of Operations and Finance attended as my guest. it was a lot of fun, and I got to do a toast in Latin, so pretty interesting. And besides that, we did some interviews for the External Communications and Media Advisor position, who is Simon Yakulik, and he'll be starting this Thursday, so I'm really excited to have him join the team. And yeah, a few other meetings, but that's all the important stuff.
Thank you very much. Vice President Sumar.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. I have a lot of stuff to add to my good report. First off, last week, the executives had a chance to meet with the registrar's office. We got a chance to talk about our goals at the registrar's office and also about some of the stuff they want to do this year. So I think that was really good to meet. Next is, I think most of the executives attended this, but there was a campus campaign open house on Friday. I got a chance to see that in the space. Great. I recommend you all go check it out. Also, I talked to one of the members who brought the campus food bank and said they had some things with their board of directors. So if you have any questions about that, let me know. Next thing is this past Monday, we had a community standards review committee meeting to talk about the possible elections for the residents. This morning, myself and Vice President Operations and Finance, we got a tour of the cost center grounds, so we got to see what exactly is going to be happening and where it's going to be happening, so that was really great. And yeah, that's about it. If you have any questions.
Thank you very much. So with that, moving on to committee and board reports. Is there any committees or board members who would like to make a report? Starting off with Councillor Bellinger.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. So as the interim chair, I'm happy to chair our first CAC meeting today. Four items of business we have on our list. First off, we're talking about our summer retreat for the council. We're going over the cost, the expected timeline of the events that would happen at this. We're looking at June 1st, 2nd, and 3rd, coming right up here for our retreat, and the campaign escapes. It is looking at the camp from Mulhurst. The cost is a little more nominal for that, so we're able to actually afford doing this as well. It's some great food. The downfall is that there's no provided activity that's supposed to be safe for a camp, so we'd be making our own. We talked about this in the meeting, though all of us are kind of leadership oriented folks, and that we've all worked for the campus. We all have the skills. Second, we'll talk about the Senate Nomination Committee. So if you were looking at our draft agenda, talking about nominating three student reps to the Senate, as named in that book, and that we approve that, and it'll come to us next council for council's approval. We also spoke about translators or anyone who has a barrier to interact with our council and how we get around that barrier. And we decided to ask back to have different people moving to meet with SSDS and CNIG representatives from the UA and also different colleges that train ASL interpreters. So we're going to be moving forward on that kind of larger item this year. And last thing we talked about, a little bit heatedly, was talking about the dress code that was approved by Canada Council. So just so you all know, we have approved a dress code. It's standing orders saying that we should be dressed professionally at all of our meetings. My rationale behind bringing this last year is that we do a lot of professional work already. Why not look at our meetings so that we have several folks coming in and actually be a professional group.
it's up to the date. If you want to, I do have a few questions about that. It is in standing order, so just keep that in mind for next time you're pressing two pieces for now. Maybe I'll listen to what I went through. Feel free to ask me questions about what you like.
Thank you very much. Ms. Oretiak.
Councillor Kinda gave me an oral report to read for the policy committee. She says, "Hi, Council. At our first official policy meeting last week, we went through the standing orders very thoroughly and made changes where necessary, which can be found in the minutes. Throughout the year, we have had a number of policies that need to be renewed. Hopefully, this task will be completed by September's The structure of our committee will be very similar to last year, where the latter half of the year will be spent acting as a brainstorming committee to bounce ideas off each other. If any member of council would like to contribute to the discussion, feel free to apply. Our meetings are off council Tuesdays at 5 p.m. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Are there any further reports? Sorry, Councillor Smith.
For the bylaw committee, the main focus right now is working on the replenishment bylaw, which is tied to last year's council voted in a impeachment bylaw for the executives, but as of right now, we don't have a way to fill the position, so we've been working on things through discussions with the governor's office, various people in the past bylaw committees, to try to make sure that we can have this, and also due to the fact that it would normally happen in an emergency situation, make sure that it's as expedient as possible.
Thank you very much. Are there any further reports? Okay, then we will move right into question period. So before we begin taking questions from the floor, I would ask Councillor Obiafuna if there were any clarifications that she would like on any of the answers.
No.
I suppose if it's clarification.
This isn't necessarily a clarification. I just wanted to say that each question is exactly the same, but I addressed each individual executive member.
Thank you very much. So with that, open for questions. Councillor Wynn.
I have a question for Beacon Student Life. So you were talking, you know, there's some drama going on between the RHA and the LSHA, right? And you were talking about some sort of agreement between the two parties from last council meeting. I would like to know if you can shed some light on it, and what are you planning to do to resolve the issues between the two?
Sure, that's a great question. So what we're doing right now is we're writing a memorandum of understanding between the two parties. Because I was on the RJ last year, I started doing this at the end of last year. And I've basically just been working on the document to make sure it's very comprehensive. The next step is to make sure that the RHA and both the LHSA agree with all the terms, and they just have to sign it. So hopefully that'll solve the beef between the two parties.
Thank you very much. Mr. Power.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. My question is for Councilor Bellinger. I was just wondering if local proxies are welcome to appreciate this.
So the question that you discussed that, and I would expect so, that would be something that I have to
Thank you. Ms. Oredzak.
Councillor Kenda has given me a question to Vice President Student Life Sumar. She asks, in your report, you mentioned that you will be hiring a gender-based violence project coordinator. I'm curious what prompted the creation of such a steering committee. Has there been a large amount of gender-based violence on campus?
That's a really good question. So just to give you some background on where this project comes from. Last year, Joanna Comart, which is the assistant manager of student services, and a few other people made a bid to the government to secure a contract from the government to study this. It was actually restricted to student groups and student unions, so the university could bid. But we decided to. The reason I think this study is being conducted is not necessarily because there's been a ton of gender-based violence on campus, but it's to study where it has been, how it's affecting the community, and things like that. What they're planning on doing with the information that they get from this project is to hopefully do some
implementations within the university as well as expand that to the rest of the community. I don't know if maybe she might have some more information, so I'll defer to
President Yamagishi.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. So, I guess the funding and the idea of things came from the government-based program. So there was grants that were being given out for applications for gender-based violence, and we saw a great opportunity. So because it was for prevention, we thought this was a great opportunity, and our assistant managers and services put together a very comprehensive package. We're happy to say it's garnered a lot of monetary support for the program. We're excited to move forward. There was another piece I was going to say on this. We're really happy to have it. I remember calling.
Thank you very much. Councillor Kuji-Krill.
My question is for Vice President Chung. And specifically, do students have to be on GOC to apply to the committees?
Vice President Jelen.
Thank you very much for the question. Thank you, Mr. Speaker. Thank you very much for the question. No, you don't have to be on GFC to apply to the committees. Any undergraduate student is defined per registrar's guidelines as being an undergraduate student. If you're understanding, you don't need to be a full-time undergraduate student either. You can apply on these committees. If you're interested, feel free to talk to me. Or you can go to the University of Alberta Government's website, fill out an application, I'm going to turn it to Google 3-27. As soon as possible, and until students apply, we've got one student voice on a number of central committees. So thanks for the question.
Governor Kelly.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. This question is for the interim chair of PAC. In the committee, you just outline briefly some of the conversations that we had in PAC regarding the dress code. Thank you.
Great. Thank you for the question. So some of the discussions we had in CAC around the dress code, I guess I'll let you all know. First off, we discussed kind of the history behind where this came from last year. The fact that it hasn't come from an issue, it's not stemming from anything new. We already hold ourselves to a very high professional standard in terms of proceeding our meetings, and this will be reflective of that within our address. We did discuss how this could be seen as possibly classist, that students may not be able to be accommodated to the weather, say it's minus 40, how would it be addressed professionally at minus 40 was a concern that got brought up. I believe that was the main gist of it, as well as the fact that it focuses a lot on professionals within how it's written in the standing orders, that's the connotation of that, which we had been arguing this back and way about what is professional and is that an appropriate word to use within our standing orders, and should we be legislating that? It's my opinion that we should be legislating this. We should be held to a higher standard. We do represent students, and I don't know, my personal check is if I look down, I don't feel like I'd be looked upon kindly by students that I'm representing it. There's a lot of changes that are coming. So, heads up.
Thank you very much. President Yamagishi.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. My question is for the interim chair of CAC. You may have explained this in your report, but I didn't quite get it. I was wondering if there's any proposed dates for the council retreat and which ones are available for this to happen, because I know the executive schedule is pretty difficult to capture right now.
Yeah, thanks for the question. We did talk about this, and I just touched on it very briefly. So I was looking at the best in terms of the execs I can make it. So Mark, we went with the first, second, and third. Where the only person who actually can't make it as per my list is Mark for Friday, Saturday. She's going to chill out and kind of catch up with us on the Sunday with this presentation, which was fantastic last year. Also, the fact that the dates we choose, we're limited in what camp we can go to. We can't just choose either camp on a certain date because the focus is outside of it. So, if we chose to go with the first, second, and third, which I believe was the most financially and just generally feasible option, we'd be at Camp Mulhurst. Which is an hour to town. If we went for the 8th, 9th, and 10th, we'd have a couple of execs who couldn't participate on the Saturday and the Sunday. And we've got Camp Worm, which is also an hour the other way, which is 2 seconds here. And the 15th, 16th, 17th, well, the execs are all the way on the 15th to a retreat, and then another exec can make the rest of the weekend. Point of information to it.
Thank you. I was just wondering if CAC was informed that that myself and my husband external will be in Lethbridge on Friday the 1st. We'll be traveling on the 2nd.
We weren't informed of that. It's not on my calendar that I was given. Of all your schedules. So we weren't aware of that, and we have to take that into consideration. Perhaps the exec would have to arrive late.
Thank you very much. Just a few quick reminders. Just if you have a question for the chair about how something's going, point of parliamentary inquiry. If you have a question for someone who's answering your question, point of information, and their microphone has to still be on when you ask point of information, and they can decide to take it or not to take it. And also, if you're on the speakers list, you don't have to raise your placard every single time. If I look at you and acknowledge you, then that means that you're going to be on the speakers list. There may be others in front of you. If you speak and you're asking a second question, then I'm always going to prioritize individuals who haven't asked a question yet, which is why some of you may be taking longer time. Just a couple notes. So with that, Councillor Lay.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. My speakers are my questions for Vice President Bismuth. Would you be able to follow up on the results of the Get Out to Vote campaign?
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. Actually, that's one of the things we talked about during our cause retreat at the cause or which love. Now, we have still, that's actually kind of one of our first pictures. Full evaluation and reports on the actual campaign itself, but so far we're considering it a success, but I'll still keep you guys posted and agreed on what's going on. But Apathy Scoring, another organization that kind of gets students to go to get out the vote, is also doing evaluation. So I'll keep you posted on that. But thanks for the great question.
Thank you. Councillor Obiefuna.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. I have a question for Vice President Chellen. I was reading your report and you talked about the assessment and grading system that's going through the GFC at this moment. Well, not probably at this time. And the departments are going to be able to change the grading system without notifying the students. Was there a rationale behind that and why that power was given?
Thank you very much, Mr. Speaker. Thank you very much for the question, Councillor Obiefuna. I'm glad someone asked that. I think that's a really important question to ask. For a little bit of background for Council, the university's been looking at the way it assesses students for the past 3 years. As many of you are aware, in the University of Alberta calendar, there's a guideline that says that the top 3% of students get an A+, top 5 get an A, etc., etc. That's typically referred to as the curve, and in a study commissioned by the provost 3 years ago, it turned out that there's only about 2 universities in 24 comparative institutions that follow that curve. It's really outdated. It doesn't make pedagogical sense to try and fit a group of very diverse students on the curve. So the U of A has been taking a look at trying to find ways to change the grading system to make it fairer for students, to make it more transparent for students, and the SU has been heavily involved in that over 2 years, 2009 to 2011. Between 2011 and 2012, there was a lull. We didn't hear anything about it. And then about a month ago, it appeared on meeting agendas that they were proposing a new policy, and this new policy gives departments the ability to build their own curve, say that 5% of students get A+ and 30% of students fail. And departments can build their own curve, and never are they ever required to communicate it to students on the syllabus, in the calendar, or in a faculty or department-specific guideline. The SU, as well as the GSA, voted against this policy at the recent GSA executive meeting. And we scheduled a meeting with Vice Provost Bill Connor on it. But fundamentally, the Students Union collectively believes that students ought to understand where their grades come from, and a hidden grading curve that only department heads have access to, I don't think fits with that. So the SU and the GSA are doing their best to see something else happen, but otherwise it will be voted on at the GSC meeting on May 20th.
Thank you very much. Councillor Wynn.
I have a question for Mr. VP External. So on the report you talk about regulating, market modifiers, cutting property taxes on the dorm, cutting mandatory fee. So what about working on policy or lobbying to increase the funding for university? And another question is one of your job descriptions is to raise awareness to, like, you know, about the concern to the larger group, the community. Any plan of actions on that?
Vice President Kuzmu.
Thank you for that excellent question, Mr. Speaker. So in regards to your latter question in terms of raising awareness to the greater community, so I'm doing that multiple ways. I guess something else that I perhaps failed to miss my report is that I've done several interviews so far. I think you guys might be familiar with this. I've done a CBC radio interview. In addition to that, I've also done various interviews for the newspapers already. So that's kind of my way of raising student concerns to the public eye. In addition to that, during some time it's kind of slow, but I'm drafting this plan of having a lobby team, so trying to raise awareness to students as well. And in terms of the fact of why we're not asking the government for more operational grants, I guess it's kind of what you're alluding to. Well, considering that we're representing students and representing the interests of students right now, are the students who need main focus is ensuring that we can get students foot in the door in the first place, right? So ensuring that there's affordability, there's accessibility, and there's predictability in planning for getting a degree. So that's our main priorities. We're not against universities getting more money. We have stance, you know, our provincial lobby group cause has stances on things such as the Access to the Future Fund, and that's where, let's say, people who donate to universities will get their dollars matched up, and that way, you know, universities get more money. So, I mean, we have stances that are pro that, but we believe that we should be putting students' priorities at the forefront and making sure that everyone has a chance of getting an education if you have the marks, and finances shouldn't be an issue like that. So, I'm glad that you brought up that issue, and it's greater philosophical, I guess, thing that our students need to lose in. So, hopefully it resonates with you guys.
Thank you very much. Vice President Shima.
My question is for President Yamagishi. I'm just wondering if the President remembered what he's going to say at the end of his last answer.
President Yamagishi.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. So, just that part that I forgot about, the Prevention of Gender-Based Violence Project. What we could do is, hopefully the results of the program and the coordinator's research could be used to work with the peer support center to possibly work with their training program to see if there's any way we can help train on gender-based violence. Yeah, that's what it is.
Thank you very much. Councillor Bellinger.
Thank you very much, Mr. Speaker. My question is for anyone on the policy committee who feels free to answer, except the chair is not here. I've looked online and the minutes aren't posted yet, but the agenda has been from the past policy meeting when your amendments were made to the standing orders. I'm wondering if evidence-based policy has been brought up at that meeting as a note, that if that was passed or not. My apologies again for not being there. I'm waiting for you.
Questions have to be addressed to an individual member of council. I was going to direct it to the chair, but I will direct that one to Vice President Kuzmu, who can defer if you would like to.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. I'll defer it now to Councillor Smith, but if he wants to defer back, thank you.
We didn't actually get through all of it. Just if I'm understanding your question correctly, we actually get through all of the standing orders. So we were just going to the review process, and we didn't get to that. But if Councillor, or sorry, Vice President,
yes, that's quite accurate what Councillor Smith has said, and also that's something that we brought up, that Councillor Bellinger has a lot of interest in this, and that this is something we're not just going to kind of, I guess you could say, not really much thought into. This is something that we're considering having a great debate, and in my role as transitioning Councillor Kinda as chair to, you know, as her being chair of the policy committee, that's something that we talked about a lot, and she's very interested, from my understanding, of working on this issue a lot. So I'm really looking forward to future talks on this. I think there's a lot of merit behind it.
Thank you very much. Councillor Kuchikrill.
My question is addressed to Councillor Bellinger, and I just want to confirm whether the dress code will be enforced and what are possible penalties.
Thank you very much for the question. This is another point of discussion that I guess I forgot to mention. It's not really enforceable, as it is a general standard. Asking to be dressed professionally does carry many different connotations, and it's very tough to nail it down. Council that restricting it to, you know, a set of rules like you must wear a tie, you must wear pants, you must wear this, that, and whatever, would be too restrictive. It would give us the ability to remove members from council chambers, I suppose, but I mean, we all have the ability to do that anyway, so that's standing orders, so the speaker does as well. You know, I don't see it as a big issue. But again, the only loss that I see with not dressing professionally is the image that representatives is tarnished. So, yeah.
Thank you very much. And that brings us to the end of our first 15 minutes. I have two names on the speakers list. I will move on unless there are five placards to extend question period. I do. Moving on, so we'll extend for another 15 minutes. Mr. Power.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. My question is for Vice President Stephen Leif. I was just wondering, with the whole LHSA RA, what the new agreement document, I can't remember what you called it, what that actually, what are some of the specifics of the order, some of the terms on, and is there a possibility that the LHSA might be integrated within the RHA?
Thanks. Thank you. Great question. So a few different things that are contained within the memorandum include constitutional changes on both sides. So a few changes to be made on the RIA's constitution as well as on the LHSA's side. The RIA constitution is relatively new in terms of a lot of the clauses in it. It was basically redone by the former Vice President Stephen Leif, Rory Tide. But it's been a few months ago from the ground up, so there's also sort of any possible ramifications in terms of legal things are also without with that agreement. Personally, I would love it if during the course of this year we could reintegrate the LHSA to the RHA because that's a matter for the RHA's executive and the RHA's council. But I think it's in the LHSA's best interest. I'll defer to President Yamaguchi.
Thank you. I think one important thing to note is that the LHSA is going to still be represented by the LHSA as a non-voting member. So in terms of advocacy, if the RHA went to a committee such as the Residents Budget Advisory Committee and spoke on their view on fee increases for the year, they could still speak on behalf of LHSA students. The only difference is that the LHSA will not have a vote on the Residents Hall Association Council. However, they can still be in attendance and speak as a non-voting member. So yeah, I can defer back to the Vice President.
Sorry, one more specific clause that's contained within the memorandum, both of the both parties agree to, is that formally, before this whole couple, the RHA was, their slogan was basically that they represented all students who live in residence. One of the clauses within the memorandum is to make sure that the other state still stands by that, the RHA still represents all students.
Thank you very much. Councillor Obiafuna.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. This question is for Vice President Kuzma. I remember during the last council meeting you asked us to document instances of students being permitted from voting. I mean, prevented, there we go, from voting. How is that going?
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. Thanks for the great question, Council. Four people respond to this, so it's not as much as I'd like it. Again, it wasn't so much to be giving to people who, let's say, weren't able to vote, but who just had challenges or faced great challenges from Alberta elections when they're trying to vote. So if you guys know anyone, Councilor Power, or if you know of anyone who had any challenges with voting, please, again, spread this. Spread the survey. That's something that we actually just talked about a couple hours ago, of making sure that we want to keep the momentum going, the hammering elections out there. I'll learn about this. We're one of the chief guys about this, I think, in like a couple of weeks or so. So the more surveys we have, the better our case, the stronger our case will be. So, yeah, thanks for bringing that up and spread the word.
Thank you very much, and that brings us to the end of our list. Are there any further questions? Okay, so we'll close question period, and with that, is there any further business? Seeing none, I will move to adjourn at 7:40. Stick around for attendance, please.
Are you allowed to adjourn?
I am allowed to adjourn. I just looked it up. Okay. President Yamagishi. Vice President Chellen.
Present.
Vice President Kuzmu.
Present.
Vice President Chima.
Present.
Vice President Sumar.
Hello.
Governor Kelly.
Present.
Councillor Milner.
Present.
Councillor Kim.
Present.
Mr. Hanwell.
Present.
Ms. Ordzik.
Present.
Councillor Mills.
Present.
Councillor Ruth.
Present.
Councillor Borden.
Present.
Councillor Lay.
Present.
Councillor Holt. Councillor Smith.
Present.
Councillor Mikula. Councillor Curlew. Councillor Lang.
Here.
Councillor Crone. Councillor Babick. Councillor Ritz.
Yep.
Councillor Carson. Councillor Bellinger. Councillor Chaudhry.
Present.
Mr. Power.
Present.
Councillor Trong. Councillor Kuchi Krill. Councillor Nguyen.
Present.
Councillor Pham.
Present.
Councillor Bui.
Present.
Councillor Obiafuna.
Present.
Councillor Hodson. And I'm here. Thank you very much. I keep on... Well, I don't know why. I cannot pronounce your last name.
My name is really intimidating. I understand. It's okay.
How do you like, say it?
Ordzak.
Ordzak.
It's like two syllables.
Ordzak. That's not that bad.
Think of it as no Y. Just Ordzak. Exclude the Y.
Okay. I did that exact same thing last time. Okay.
You know,
Ordzak.
I understand. It's okay.
Sorry, you kind of blew by me. I don't know. I didn't think I said Carson, but I'm here. So, Carson Bell.
Oh, Leon Bell?
Yeah.
Okay, perfect.
Great, thanks. Yeah. Oh.
Called out on it.
Yeah.